We learn new things about the brain all the time, which parts of the brain handle which of the duties of the mind and things like that. Once we have that information, what do we do with it? Ultimately, a connection is needed between knowing which parts of the brain light up and helping people with issues they have with their minds. And that is why the University of Oregon started up something called the Center for Translational Neuroscience. CTN opened up this fall, and its director is our guest. That would be Phil Fisher, who is the Philip Knight Chair of Psychology and the University of Oregon's Director of Clinical Training. Dr. Fisher, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thanks, Jeff. Great to be here.
Before we add the translational part, can you give us a refresher course on what is meant by neuroscience? It seems like that term has exploded in the last 5 to 10 years.
Sure. I mean, basically, neuroscience is the study of the brain. But I think the thing that's really made a tremendous difference in the last, actually, 10 to 15 years is abilities to image what's going on in the brain so that instead of it being somewhat of a black box where we know only by inference what might be happening, we're actually able to see various areas of the brain that become active in response to specific tasks or experiences that people have through technologies like functional magnetic resonance imaging and EEG and ERP methodologies.
Sounds like the fMRI is the big one that's really given us a chance to literally see what parts of the brain light up when things happen.
Absolutely.
All right, so we add the translational part now and tell us what's being translated here.
Yeah, you know, a lot of the work that has been done historically in neuroscience has been really instrumental in telling us how the brain works. The translational part that we've been working on adding is to really understand how to apply this knowledge to address real-world problems. So we're particularly interested in individuals who have experienced high levels of adversity and stress early in their lives, and I'm happy to talk with you a little bit more about why early life is so important.
Okay. But
also not only characterizing sort of how those experiences affect the brain, but then one of the marvelous things about the brain is that it shows plasticity. It actually changes, and we know this, for instance, from people who have strokes and lose the ability to walk or to talk can regain capacity and ability to do those things. So we're really interested in leveraging what we know about the brain's plasticity to help improve outcomes for individuals who have had less than optimal experiences.
So the translational really figures out ways to turn research about the brain itself into clinical approaches.
Clinical approaches, but we're particularly interested not just in rehabilitation from things like traumatic brain injury and things like that, but actually into more things that have a social focus, so things like poverty and child maltreatment and neglect, how it is that we can develop programs that leverage what we know about the brain's plasticity to help individuals who are raised in poverty, who experience discrimination and disadvantage and so forth, or who might be involved with the child welfare system to experience better outcomes.
So what do we know then about those, the circumstances you just mentioned, poverty and child maltreatment and neglect? I mean, do the brains actually function differently? Do they light up differently under different stimuli?
Yeah, you know, some of the work that we've done here and that's been done elsewhere as well has really found that those kinds of experiences, especially when they happen either during the prenatal period or in the early years of life, have a tremendous impact on the developing brain. And there are some particular systems that we know are especially affected by those kinds of experiences. Some of the ones that people probably have heard the most about involve the prefrontal cortex, or the area in the front of the brain that's responsible for so-called executive functioning, which has to do with things like self-control, the ability to regulate emotions and so forth, as well as the system that's involved in the production of so-called stress hormones, things like cortisol, that help the body kind of return to a normal balance when individuals experience stress. And what we're finding, and again, this has been not only done here, but in many other places as well, is that early stressful experiences really do shape the architecture of the brain in such ways that really lead to limitations in the development of those brain systems in ways that have lifelong consequences for individuals' well-being. So there really is clearly a story to be told there about how experiences can shape brain architecture.
Is it as simple as saying that that if you grow up in stressful conditions early in life that you might have underdeveloped executive functions?
Well, of course, you know, it's not as simple as that, although I think that's a really good characterization. The part that's perhaps the most important to point out is that we see huge variation. So although you can make that general statement, it's also true, of course, that many individuals show remarkable resiliency in the face of very challenging early experiences. But as a general rule, we do find that stressful early experiences do seem to be associated with some diminished executive functioning in individuals, absolutely.
Dr. Phil Fisher is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the Philip Knight Chair of Psychology and the University of Oregon's Director of Clinical Training and the Director of the Center for Translational Neuroscience, or CTN, which we're talking about here and now. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Phil, what do we know about you talked about the plasticity of the brain. I mean, if we're delayed in developing things like the prefrontal cortex or just developing the executive functions within that cortex, do we have to then migrate them to different parts of the brain, or can those parts be developed later?
That's a great question, Jeff. So it's sort of like, are there ways that we can compensate, or is it possible for the regions that we see having diminished or altered function, is it possible for those areas to kind of show progression or change across time? To a certain extent, it depends on the specific region of the brain that we're talking about. So one of the things that's wonderful about the prefrontal cortex, where executive functioning lies, is that it's a relatively late maturing area of the brain. It takes a long time to develop, and in fact, there are large aspects of development that occur during adolescence and even all the way into early adulthood. This means that the system remains much more pliable, for better or for worse. So to the extent that individuals continue to experience stressful early environments that go on into adolescence and adulthood, it can really have a kind of an additive effect. But it also means that improved environments seem to be able to really create more improved functioning in those regions of the brain. And we have some great evidence, even from programs that we've done with partners at a research institute here in town in Eugene, that shows that it's possible with kids who are about to start kindergarten to really get areas in the front of the brain more active in response to when kids are getting feedback that they're making mistakes and so forth, which are areas that are, again, connected to executive functioning.
Are there windows? I mean, I remember reading not that terribly long ago about therapies with people who were deaf. They did not have hearing, and then people had asked for cochlear implants. Their parents had asked for cochlear implants by the time they were in their 20s, and I remember reading that it was a case of the window kind of closing on the development of language skills if you didn't have them. And I mean, are there other windows in the brain where you're kind of done? You can't go back and get the stuff you don't already have there?
Well, we used to think that there were so-called critical periods. It was sort of like make-or-break times when certain areas of the brain were maturing, and if you didn't have the correct kind of inputs during those times, that it was a done deal. That school of thought has been revised from thinking about critical periods to thinking about sensitive periods. So the boundaries of those windows, rather than thinking about them as open or shut, I think it's a question of the degree to which they're open and shut in response to input from the world around. There's also some really phenomenal work that's being done, not at the University of Oregon, but elsewhere with collaborators that we have, looking at how those windows, even if they appear to be passed, can be reopened. And at present, most of that work involves pharmacological or medication-based approaches, but really what we're trying to do is unlock the extent to which once a time might be passed, it's possible to recreate the plasticity that might have existed to create healthy neural circuitry in particular areas of the brain.
All right, so not a, you know, done by this date kind of thing, but a much
right.
more fluid kind of, flexible kind of set of timelines.
Absolutely, and definitely that's, I would say, a very active frontier in neuroscience right now. That's more in the basic neuroscience area, but as you, I think, drew the connections, it has tremendous implications for the so-called translational neuroscience focus.
So at the Center for Translational Neuroscience, it sounds like you're an institute, that you pull in people from a bunch of different fields?
That's right. So one of the things that's really unique about the environment at the University of Oregon is that there are a number of people across disciplines So rather than simply in the cognitive neuroscience area or in psychology, we have people in education, we have people in counseling psychology and human physiology, all of whom are really interested in these issues. And the center exists within a larger institute called the Prevention Science Institute, where we're really, as a group, dedicated to trying to address these kind of social problems that I mentioned. As you can imagine, the knowledge for the basic neuroscience, as well as the knowledge for how to effectively develop programs and evaluate them within community settings, all of these require a high level of expertise. And it's really, we're finding more and more that team science approaches are critical to bringing together the right knowledge base in order to address these complex problems in real-world settings. And really what we found was that there was this fantastic and pretty unique constellation of researchers here in Oregon who have really wonderful connections in community settings to address these issues. And that's really what led the Center for Translational Neuroscience to coalesce.
Phil Fisher is the director of the Center for Translational Neuroscience at the University of Oregon and the Philip Knight Chair of Psychology and the University of Oregon's Director of Clinical Training. You can join our discussion about translational neuroscience here on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Are there some specific behavior sets you're targeting here, that things you'd like to correct or develop therapies for through the CTN?
Yeah, I mean, the primary areas that we're focusing on as an initial set, and it really reflects more of the expertise of people involved than anything. I think we have lots of potential to expand. But there are several particular domains. One that we're very interested in is how children who come from very adverse backgrounds are able to successfully function when they end up in academic settings, so when they transition to school. And in order to successfully function in school, it's really important that kids are able to effectively pay attention. All the things that we see kind of kindergartners and first graders learning, that when they want to do something and they see something that somebody else has, that they can wait their turn or learn to raise their hand. And also that they're just able to process information clearly. So all of those skills that are associated with early learning are really important for us. That's one area. Another area that we're very interested in, and this goes back a long way, is really promoting healthy parenting. We have developed a video coaching approach that involves essentially extracting what we call serve and return moments, which are these moments that in which a child is doing something to explore the world, serving essentially like in a tennis game. Parents notice the serve and return it by responding and supporting the child, by encouraging them, by using words to name what they're seeing. Turns out that the serve and return process really occurs even in families that typically might be considered very low skilled. Parents who've had their kids removed and are having visitation in child welfare, parents in inpatient drug treatment. We see the serve and return happening frequently. And the video coaching approach that we've used and developed is really a way to help individuals see when they're doing these things that naturally occur in everyday life and that we know are sort of the building blocks of healthy brain development. So that's a second. And the third has to do with the areas of self-control that are often involved in people having issues around addiction, smoking cessation, overeating, all of the self-control issues that we see that have become increasingly recognized as public health problems around people having weight problems and related health issues, wanting to quit smoking and having a difficult time doing so, and obviously with drugs and alcohol. So those right now are the primary areas. But as I said, I think we will continue to add additional ones that have to do more with health and well-being as time goes by and more people join our center.
Let's come back to the healthy parenting part where you were talking about the serve and return process.
Sure.
Is that like mirroring and just engaging with the child, let them know they've been heard, that sort of thing?
Well, it's right. It's a pretty commonly occurring thing. So children naturally do many things to serve when they're exploring the world around them. They look at things, they point, they vocalize. We're talking about infants and toddlers here, but also, older kids. And one of the things that's most critical that really helps build not only healthy brains, but also we know is at the root of things like language development and the ability to even read and write, is when parents respond to these serves that children put out. And so returning the serve can happen in a number of different ways, but and it doesn't have to be when a child is doing something positive. It can also be when a child is upset or distressed, and the parent, supports the child by acknowledging and potentially naming the feeling that they're having. Oh, you're sad, or oh, you're feeling frustrated right now. Those kinds of moments are really critical because they begin to help the child draw associations between their actions and reactions that occur. Between, for instance, if they point at something, the idea that that object has a name. It's actually one of the key ways that kids learn to read is that they're looking at words on a page, and the adult may be saying the words on the page, and the child understands that these symbols correspond to sounds, and things build from there. So it's really one of the things that's really nice about serve and return is that it provides sort of this fundamental foundation for most of what develops subsequently to come out. And so instead of saying, well, we want to talk to parents about how to teach their kids to read, and we also want to talk to them about how to manage their emotions and so on and so forth, this is really a core process that we can focus on. And using video allows us to really extract instances. So instead of trying to teach people new skills, we're really showing them the strengths that they already have and helping them build upon it. And it's a very, we think, efficient and effective way of helping to promote healthy parenting in a way that is really positive and that parents, and for that matter, their children really like to be involved in.
And not so much learning new stuff, but just tuning up the things you're doing right already.
Right. And, there's been a lot of talk about so-called strength-based interventions. Oftentimes that means just sort of focusing on positive things. But we see this as sort of the ultimate strength-based approach. It's called FIND, which stands for Filming Interactions to Nurture Development. Because what it does is to really extract things that people are already doing. And so I think especially for people here, have had a lot of parents tell us, I didn't have a lot of confidence in my parenting, or I didn't think I knew what I was doing, and what you showed me was that I already had a lot of skills that I could use to help support my child, which is really kind of a game changer for a lot of parents who maybe didn't have the best experiences being parented themselves when they were younger and so forth.
We're talking to Dr. Phil Fisher, the director of the Center for Translational Neuroscience at the University of Oregon here on the Jefferson Exchange. Is there a holy grail, Phil? I mean, a steepest mountain to climb in making behavioral changes that you think would be like a major focus of the CTN?
I think that it's less about a single sort of magic bullet that's going to solve things. One of the things that we've really learned over the course of time that we've been involved in this work is that the changes are additive. And I think there's almost been too much attention in trying to find, the single approach that solves everything. One of the things that we're really committed to, and I think that the translational neuroscience approach can help us become much better at, is the idea of tailoring approaches to meet the needs of individuals and having a spectrum of effective strategies that are useful. So, for instance, a child that's coming into a new classroom and may not be, sort of perfectly set up to be ready to learn could have a number of different things going on. It could be that they simply need, more help focusing their attention. But it could be that if a child's coming from a very stable or unstable background, say they're in a foster home and they've moved around a lot and they've had some difficult early experiences, that they have a lot of anxiety to manage as well. Right now, we might just say, well, there's a one-size-fits-all approach that we're doing, which is, to try to help that child fit in and be able to learn. But I think what this approach can do is really help us become much clearer that, this isn't simply a problem with attention focusing, that there might be a lot of anxiety as well, and we have approaches that we know now can more effectively target those kinds of things. So I think the holy grail, if anything, is becoming much smarter in how we tailor approaches to meet the needs of specific individuals and do so in a way with these, like I was talking about, the video coaching, with approaches that are not necessarily, you know, break the bank kinds of approaches because they're such high intensity and have to be delivered for so long.
So we're talking incremental change here. I mean, things where you reinforce what works well and just don't do what doesn't work well.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think also where we've become much smarter about saying, well, this is what's going on in these kinds of settings. I'll give you a really quick example of this. So one of the, I mentioned this earlier, but one of the things that we found early on with kids in foster care was that when we gave them a computer task to do in the laboratory, and we measured, this was using electrical activity on the surface of the brain, a technique called event-related potential measuring. We noticed that when kids were performing this task, in which they essentially had to not push a button in certain circumstances where they were sort of primed to do so, and they got feedback when they made mistakes, they got a little frowny face that came on the screen. We saw that kids from difficult early backgrounds showed very little activation in the front of the brain compared to what you would expect to see and what we saw in non-maltreated community kids. And it was as if the amount of brain activity necessary to really notice and respond to the corrective feedback was absent in these kids. That's really important because I think what you often see in classroom settings is teachers will say, this child, you know, doesn't really want to learn and is not that interested in learning. And what we saw was it was really much more an issue of information not getting through as opposed to, you know, a desire on the part of the child to learn or not learn.
Wow, so much to learn about brain development, and it sounds like really fascinating work you guys are doing at the Center for Translational Neuroscience. Dr. Phil Fisher at the University of Oregon is the director of that center. Thanks so much for joining us today in The Exchange.
My pleasure.